I'm Fulbright Anderson.
And I'm Mike Halverson. We're a student faculty research team in the Department of History at Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington. Welcome to Innovative History, a podcast brought to you by Dale Benson and the Benson Family Foundation. Innovative History shows history in motion and is driven by academic and technological breakthroughs.
For this episode, we're discussing history and how video games interact with cultural forces in history. We're also seeing how video games impact historical storytelling, what the potential of this exciting medium is doing for people learning about and teaching history. Today we're asking, what is history? What is cultural history? And how do cultural themes impact video game content?
Our work is grounded in two recent texts, Gamer Nation by John Wills and Virtual History, How Video Games Depict the Past by A. Martin Wainwright. Check the episode description for a complete list of resources.
After the short break, we're beginning our discussion with history and how it connects to historical video games.
The Benson Family Foundation supports a range of academic initiatives at PLU, from student scholarships to faculty and staff programming to research fellowships that pair students and faculty members together to research interesting topics in business and economic history, innovation, and other areas. During summer 2021, three student faculty research teams are exploring new subjects at PLU, including Fulton Brian Anderson and I on new directions in historical research. We are deeply grateful to the Benson Family Foundation for their support.
Welcome back to Innovative History. Mike, I have a question for you. How do professional historians study history?
Fulton, this is a great question. History is ultimately an interpretation of past events. The past is the sum total of everything that's happened everywhere. But that's too much information to put into a book or an article. And there are so many perspectives and events that the past becomes boring or incoherent if we tell it all in one sitting. Instead, historians tend to create interesting narratives about the past that are accurate and true, if somewhat selective.
I get that, but what about the sources you use to create these stories?
Well, historians have traditionally used written sources, which we typically divide into primary sources and secondary sources. These primary sources are original documents from the past, essentially eyewitness testimony about what happened. Secondary sources are later interpretations created by historians and other scholars or journalists. And when there are gaps or inconsistencies, we look for more sources or use theoretical ideas to fill in the blanks. Historians are essentially detectives, and we like to focus on interpretive problems or challenging cases to move our understanding of the past forward.
Can you describe how you mix research of researching these sources and teaching in a university setting? How are researching and teaching connected?
Well, the research part of a history graduate school program prepares a person to go off and do original research in one or more fields. And those kind of change over time as people publish and interact with other scholars. So I've been doing that since graduate school and have continued that work at PLU and often engage students in that. So this summer research fellowship that we're doing is an example of that, but I also engage students in other types of research. And then teaching is really an opportunity to share what I've learned, both picking really interesting sources for students to read and then discussing them together. We don't really have classic long lectures anymore in college classes. Have kind of a mix of conversation, reflection, and primary source analysis and things like that. So I teach typically 3 or 4 days a week and also find a little time for research and then work within the local university community. Fulton, tell me a little bit about your college history course experiences. What's it like for you as a student?
Yeah, so I'm in the classroom engaging in discussion with my classmates, and we're really analyzing sources that are either primary or secondary that we read before class and annotate and take notes and all the other things that you would do while reading. We really personalize history rather than read and remember it. So a test would be analyzing some sources given to us on the day of the test rather than coming in and remembering dates and names and what happened. So it ultimately goes beyond, you know, reading a book or browsing the web and remembering all these things.
Yeah, what are some of the ways that you see different ideas interacting in the study of history?
So environmental history is my favorite discipline when it comes to this. And it's really easy to break down its entire ecosystem. First, we can look at the environment, so the flora, fauna, and then structures like buildings and roads, and how those interact with politics, laws, and decisions made by the government, along with the citizens in those communities and their responses to that. So like I said, you're analyzing an entire ecosystem to create a story of the past.
And what do you think the outcomes will be for your study of history at PLU? What are the main things you're going to get out of that?
Well, the first thing that I know I will be learning is Chicago Manual style.
Aha, Chicago Manual of Style. Very nice. So how are you doing in your citations?
I believe they're proper and attributed right.
Well, this is a system that allows people to cite their primary and secondary sources in their papers. And so we do ask students to learn that system as a way of grounding their sources. But there is more to writing than that, Fulton. Can you describe what you've been learning about writing as part of our program?
Yeah, it's been developing a narrative to engage with the past and make it interesting. And it pushes my writing in new directions. It makes me flexible in how I write. So you have to consider, where do you place sources in papers? I know many times where it's like, oh, I should maybe move this section to the end because it'll be more powerful and impact the reader. But you also have to think of how long they've been reading this and all these other executive decisions that come with general writing, whether you're an author for a novel or making something nonfiction like history.
Yeah, writing is very personal for students, and we coach students to do all kinds of writing, and they really get to explore their own feelings, their own creativity as they do it. And we also get students to work together. Fulton, can you talk a little bit about how students work in partnership and also connect to the local community?
Yeah, one of the in-classroom examples I can think of is presenting primary source analysis with classmates and bringing up discussion and developing discussion questions, but that percolates into the community.
And then you've connected with Tacoma a little bit in some of your classes, I think.
Yeah, Professor Mergenthal's History of the Pacific Northwest and Western States basically dived into Tacoma and their history of anti-Asian sentiment, and you get to look at sources from then. And also, outside of the history department, I studied away in Nea Bay with the Macaw Indian Nation, which was really about building connections and seeing the cultural anthropology and history of this people who are completely different from us people in Tacoma or Seattle. What I really want to do is find that balance to make history engaging and exciting for all audiences, regardless of your degree, profession, education level, or whatever it is. You just have to be excited about understanding where we are and where we came from.
Well, that's fantastic. After the break, we'll look a little bit more at cultural history and how it impacts video games. The Department of History at PLU offers compelling coursework, individualized instruction, and innovative student-faculty research opportunities, including special programs in innovation studies and Holocaust and genocide studies. Prepare for your future by studying the past. See www.plu.edu/history for more information.
So Mike, what is cultural history and why does it matter?
Cultural history is one way of studying what happened in past societies. It really emerged in the 1960s and 70s as scholars began to realize that some groups and events were being left out of the study of the past, particularly marginalized groups, women, and interesting activities that made groups unique. Cultural history really values individual experiences and the activities and ideas that bind groups together over time. Cultural historians study societies from the ground up, examining human behavior and neglected sources that document social and cultural changes. These sources might include artistic expression, popular ceremonies, clothing, food, human experiences like sexuality or religious expression. Gender, race, and ethnicity are also very popular topics, as is the struggle for civil rights and social and economic equality. Cultural historians study dominant groups, but also the experiences of those who are on the margins of society, because the margins often reflect or mirror the values of those in power. For this reason, cultural historians are intrigued with persecuted groups, crime, drug use, prostitution, revolutionaries, and rebels. Fulton, you've been exposed to some of this thinking in your courses. How would you say these themes are portrayed in recent video games?
Well, I can first of all think about Rockstar Games and as we have discussed, their game series, Red Dead Redemption, tries to depict the cultural attributes of the Old West. For example, we can see architectural elements of Old Western towns like saloons, stagecoaches, the telegraph, gambling with Five Finger Filet, Liar's Dice, or poker, clothing, you can wear a white Stetson hat, engage in horse culture, and cultural stereotypes related to competing groups like indigenous peoples, Pinkerton agents, southern planters, and various western gangs. In switching time periods entirely, Rockstar Games' other series, Grand Theft Auto, critiques contemporary Los Angeles culture with its obsession with glamour, automobiles, movie stars, sexuality, drugs, and violence. Rather than major events in history, American culture is the focus, and it is criticized by Rockstar Games. By invoking these stereotypes and tropes about California and Los Angeles, the designers are showing the cultural underbelly of America and the American dream. It's essentially a TV show entourage for old school HBO fans. There's some issues with it. In some ways, it is also a dystopian view of the US fueled by anxieties about capitalism and the so-called culture wars. These game developers are highly aware of these worlds that they're creating and these cultures and how they are interpreting them. So Mike, do open-world video game environments make these cultural themes any more significant?
Open-world environments let you explore cultural settings on your own, and for this reason they can be highly immersive. If this is done well, the player can really get a feeling for a different time. For example, Assassin's Creed Syndicate from 2015 explores Victorian-era London. Skyrim explores a virtual world drawing on Viking Age and medieval themes. And L.A. Noire explores Los Angeles shortly after World War II.
And after the break, we'll look more into L.A. Noire, exploring historical content that appears in the game, including gender, ethnicity, the noir style, and more. Innovative History is recorded, edited, and made in PLU's Martin J. Neeb Center. Access to the Martin J. Neeb Center was coordinated through PLU's School of Arts and Communications. Visit plu.edu/SOAC, that's SOAC, to learn more.
L.A. Noire is a neo-noir detective action-adventure game developed by Team Bondi and published by Rockstar Games. It was released in 2011 for PlayStation 3, Xbox 360, and Microsoft Windows, and re-released in 2017 for Nintendo Switch, PlayStation 4, and Xbox One.
So Mike, when is this historical game set?
The game is set after World War II in Los Angeles, and charts the activities of Detective Cole Phelps in the LAPD as he solves a range of cases, some of which are based on real-life cases like the Black Dahlia and the death of J.D. Chitwood. The year is 1947, and Detective Phelps is enmeshed in the culture of old Los Angeles, with its undercurrents of drugs, racism, and aesthetic elements of film noir. Phelps is also a former member of the U.S. Marines, and he interacts with several former squad mates and other ex-military in the game. They are a hardened bunch who have seen a lot. So, Fulton, can you tell us a little bit about the game's open-world design? What are players able to do and see in L.A. Noire?
The open-world design of L.A. Noire lets you roam around the city's landscape on foot or by vehicle. It's a bit more linear than Red Dead Redemption and Grand Theft Auto, where case objectives drive the story along. Side activities such as stranger missions in Red Dead or Grand Theft Auto are not present in L.A. Noire. In L.A. Noire, you can respond to street crimes and find historic in-game collectibles like records, film reels, and novels, all of which involve cultural history either directly or indirectly.
I see. And how do the game mechanics work?
So the main mechanics of the game have you interrogating suspects, searching for clues at crime scenes, following up with leads, and getting into the occasional chase or shootout with noir film conventions and 40s bebop playing.
Nice.
The most notable mechanic of the game is the interrogation feature. You ask investigative questions to suspects, witnesses, and other persons of interest or POIs. The system is also innovative with technology. Team Bondi, developers of L.A. Noire, used a newer technology called motion scan, which filmed the game's actors with 32 cameras at different angles to recreate realistic facial expressions using authentic costuming and makeup from the 1940s. The actors look like themselves.
Oh, cool.
As Cole Phelps, you're tasked with reading these real faces of suspects or other POIs to determine if they're telling the truth or not. Evidence you find at crime scenes will be used when you accuse someone of lying, and the answers that you receive from POIs can make or break the case. The game mechanics definitely fit the themes here. The historical themes put you in the shoes of a LAPD detective, and it is an interesting way to recreate some of the tension of police work, whether that be questioning a murderer or a family who lost their home in a fire and inspecting a crashed car.
Don't they also use some realistic historical themes?
Yeah, so to fit the historical themes of post-war LA, Team Bondi did some historical digging like us historians. The urban landscape has elements of realism, including landmarks from old Los Angeles, which is also an in-game collectible, surprise, and realistic vehicles like Fords and Buicks, buildings and interior spaces. All of this information was sourced from vintage props, color swatches, aerial photography, and the developers bought 40s architectural magazines and books off of eBay to model interiors. But a vivid and intersectional example of this work done by Team Bondi is the jazz club, The Blue Room, on Hollywood Boulevard.
Right, The Blue Room is where the fictional character Elsa Lichtman sings with the jazz combo. And Elsa Lichtman is 30 years old, meaning that in the game she would have been born in 1917. Elsa is German, and we learn that she was in Germany during World War II, narrowly escaping, but her parents were killed by the Nazis. We also learn that she was sexually assaulted in the past, so she's a drug user, and much of the action in the game is connected to morphine use, which is prevalent at the time and is something that is a major game theme. The ground is somewhat unusual for video games discussing these issues, and we also do have a female character who is connected to a realistic past. Moreover, Elsa Lichtman is recognizable as a mysterious, sort of in-genre, dangerous woman from the film noir series. She will be connected to Detective Phelps romantically, and she largely conforms to the gender expectations of such characters.
And L.A. Noir paints a vivid backdrop of post-war Los Angeles, and it provides many opportunities to consider cultural history. When you encounter Lichtman, the story is not about major events or political leaders, it's about questionable partners in the LAPD, jazz musicians, Phelps' former squad mates, the mob, and drug dealers. Mm-hmm. Elsa Lichtman is a broken but noble character, and it is helpful to see women receiving larger parts in bigger budget video games, although Lichtman does fit into some stereotypes like you said, Mike.
Right. Most of the time, it's clear that action-adventure games have been designed for their largest audience, men aged 20 to 40. And so most of the time, we see stories that are about masculinity and subjects that are interesting to men. And in classes, we can certainly point out these masculine behaviors and identities. But for female characters, most blockbuster games simply don't feature women as the lead protagonists. If they do have women, they are often sexualized or portrayed in completely unrealistic ways. So what we historians would like to see, and I think many of us would like to see in games, is a little more agency from female characters and maybe from male characters too, and places where female characters can act in unexpected, creative ways that are not just limited to traditional or genre-type roles. In contemporary games, too, set in the present, we would like to see non-binary descriptions of gender and characters that are gay, straight, trans, or other identities, because that is how the world works.
And like how the world works, we want to see that in AAA games. Indie games are really taking a lead by trying to represent gender-based identities in authentic ways, like Gone Home, Life is Strange, and Tell Me Why, along with Undertale. But we just don't see it in those big AAA games that are selling millions of units every year. Now here's an example of the femme fatale stereotype in L.A. Noir.
Elsa. You're so full of courage, you have never felt ashamed.
This is getting us nowhere.
Do you think you'll win your war against narcotics?
It's not my war. It's against the law. My job is to prosecute the laws of this city.
Do you think you can stop people from needing drugs, detective?
I'm asking the questions here.
Then why do you come to me with your stupid questions? You know who controls the drugs in this city.
It's not enough to just survive, Elsa. You have to try and make the world a better place.
Brave words. Very noble. But words are just words, Cole Phelps.
Let's take a little deeper look at L.A. Noir and the way it depicts racial issues in gameplay.
L.A. Noire is set in 1947 Los Angeles, like we said, and the city was particularly divided over race and other issues. This is shown in the depiction of African American, Latino, and white characters, and oddly enough, there's a complete absence, nearly, of Asian American characters. Historically, this is a very important issue, all of these different racial identities here. We know that freeways were disrupting Mexican-American neighborhoods, jazz was segregated, Japanese-Americans were rebuilding after internment, and homicide ravaged the entire city.
Can you describe this in relation to the characters in the Blue Room jazz scenes, especially during the case Manifest Destiny? Elsa is backed by a band that is all African-American, right?
Yes, Mike, the five jazz musicians are African-American, and African-Americans have several roles throughout cases in the game. The scene in the Blue Room wouldn't have been typical of the era regarding their musical collaboration, or at least in the Blue Room.
How so?
Well, in the 1940s, LA's jazz scene had two distinct places. It was kind of segregated. These two places were Hollywood and Central Avenue. Hollywood was mainly for white jazzers and in-demand black jazzers at white-only clubs, so a natural comparison is Harlem in the Cotton Club or the Apollo Theater. On the other hand, Central Avenue had bands and audiences of both black and white jazzers. True integration between black and white jazzers started in San Francisco during the early 60s. All black bands were able to play in white clubs in the 1940s there, and it just kind of trickled down throughout the state, allowing, you know, these mixed bands to play in places that would have been the Blue Room. And another important note is that Central Avenue's rich jazz and African-American scene does not exist in L.A. Noire. The only insight into cats like Red Mitchell or Chico Hamilton in the bustling scene is confrontation between the LAPD and jazz agents, show promoters, jazzers, and morphine in different parts of the city.
Okay, so the depiction of neighborhood-type jazz and the places that people played is not completely realistic, but what about some of the language that's used in jazz clubs or racial language that's used throughout the game? Is it realistic? Is it disturbing?
It's both of those, Mike. The language has some elements of historical realism. The slang used by the jazz musicians in the Blue Room reminds me of Miles Davis's autobiography with Quincy Trope, and some of it can be stereotyped by looking at how the cops hassle the musicians like Count Basie or Miles Davis in real life. And Phelps's partner, Roy Earle, who drops some really loaded language. Here's an example. It's only about 5 to 10 seconds, so turn away if you need to.
Stay, Miss Lichtman. We're making inquiries into the recent deaths of four musicians.
Since when have the police cared about dead black men?
Good point. We don't. What we care about is 2 tons of army surplus morphine showing up on the street. If you care about working in this town, you better...
Aren't there some other rather disturbing scenes of racially motivated attacks in the club?
Yes, there are, Mike. Detectives Phelps and Earl question the band and suspect them of being involved with illegal activities like using morphine and other drugs. And they reveal obvious preconceptions about the African-American community. In the narrative of L.A. Noire, Phelps and Earl's only interactions with African-Americans and jazz are related to death and trafficking morphine, marijuana, and gambling, illegal gambling, that is. And there's also a long history that we know with white discomfort regarding jazz music mm-hmm. and its performers. So it's safe to say that the writers of L.A. Noire maybe portrayed Phelps and Earl to come in with a chip on their shoulder.
And this is the case with the Elsa character as well. She's German, a former enemy, and they are difficult on her, aren't they?
Exactly. Earl says racial slurs to Elsa, and Phelps even has to step in because of the romantic interest and kind of stop him and tell Earl, hey, go to the bar, I got this.
Doesn't Miles Davis's autobiography connect to this a little bit?
Yes, Mike, just a little bit. So in 1959, Miles was recording for Voice of America, and he comes outside of the club to take a break, right? And he's hanging out, you know, getting some fresh air, and then this police officer comes up to him and says, hey, you can't be out here. What are you doing? You have to go. Miles says, hey, you know, my name's up there on the marquee. I'm supposed to be here. And the officer's like, no way. You gotta scram. So the officer, you know, Miles is resisting, and the officer goes, you're under arrest. And then right as that happens, a detective around the corner or whatever comes and hits Miles, like tackles him almost and punches him, bloody him all up, and he gets arrested and taken to jail.
You know, I have been interested in L.A. Noire and its touches of realism in this way, and I've used the game, really videos, YouTube videos from the game in my history classes. I have one recent class, History of Technology in America, and I've used L.A. Noir in that setting. I've used some of the scenes involving Elsa and her band, showing them to students along with actually trigger warnings, which I've used before the videos. You know, I kind of upload them and I direct people to them. And I just say, I'm aware that some of you might be offended by this language and worried about it. And you don't have to watch the videos if you don't care to. But we are talking about race in America in the 1940s and race today. And so this might be a way in. And we know that some people have been playing this game. It's a very popular game, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It was like considered one of the best games of 2011 when it came out, and it had been in production for well over 5 years.
Yeah, and it's a very different type of game for those of you who haven't played this than a first-person shooter type game. So it's a very different type of experience. Many of the students have come in and they've said that they have appreciated looking at these clips as a companion to study history. It's a type of really primary, secondary, or creative source that we would use. Some of the students that are African American have been able to watch these clips, and they have said that they have very little trouble processing or reflecting on these scenes because they feel like this is a regular aspect of life for them. And some white students have been pretty uncomfortable because they are not expecting to see these racial confrontations in the sources that they look at or really in films or TV. And so they are a little bit more cautious about talking with them. So this is the way that we will often use cultural history in a class. We will use these approaches to kind of get at things that are not being talked about and to create a safe space where they can be talked about in a university setting. Makes it much more tangible. Fulton, what do you think about using this type of material in the classroom? Should we use L.A. Noir and other gaming content like this?
Yeah, totally, Mike. As we've brought up in previous episodes and parts of this podcast, a lot of us gamers come into the classroom with all this historical knowledge that we know from video games, but actually dissecting it and analyzing and having a conversation about the implications to this is really important. It makes video games change from something that is seen as mindless, where we just play it for entertainment and kind of pass our time, into reflection, like you're doing in class with your Innovation in America class, where you talked about L.A. Noir, because this scene could just be like, oh, it's part of the narrative, it's just a story, but it can allude to realer things in history. And I think it's important, regardless of who you are, to reflect on sensitive topics like this and at least be aware in how they're being portrayed in newer mediums.
Now, what about some of these awkward or stressful conversations in class? Can video games offer a way to get into those conversations?
I think they're definitely a way to get in with the proper trigger warnings, like you said. It feels more connected to at least student culture and life now. Video games are everywhere, and the ESA statistics prove that younger people play video games. So I feel like they are a way in, and people just have to come at it from the perspective of art, and then we can maybe compare it to an interview from the 1940s or what someone wrote in a jazz review about a combo in LA.
Yeah, I guess what we're saying, Fulton and I, are is that video games have the opportunity to present really interesting information to people who are studying history on their own or in a classroom setting. And L.A. Noir is accurate in many ways, and the amount of time they put to recreate this open world culture allows you the opportunity to kind of experience what late 1940s Los Angeles was like. And again, it's the noir format, so you're experiencing kind of a film noir version of LA, which is the same thing that we saw with Red Dead Redemption.
So with that, as we can see with LA Noir and Red Dead Redemption or Grand Theft Auto, video games reflect cultural history and they interact with it and even create their own history. They can provide valuable insight in the classroom and outside of the classroom, but Mike and I both agree that there has to be some guidance when analyzing video games as sources, or at least using them in an academic sense. There's still places where video games must improve and change to be 100% accurate or better with visibility for marginalized groups, yet they're making strides forward in smaller video game communities.
Great. Well, until next time, I'm Mike Halverson.
And I'm Fulton Brian Anderson.
Thank you for listening to Innovative History.
Innovative History is produced and recorded in association with the 2021 Benson Family Summer Research Fellowship at Pacific Lutheran University in the Martin J. Neeb Center.
Hosted by Fulton Brent Anderson and Dr. Mike Halverson, members of the Department of History at PLU, Fulton also served as the editor of the podcast. All music written and recorded by Felix Halverson. In-game audio recorded by Fulton Brent Anderson on Xbox One and Xbox One X. Technology and software provided by PLU Instructional Technologies and Laser, Loot Air Student Radio. Thank you Travis Pagel and John Schusenberg at Instructional Technologies. Thank you Rosario Yosen, Sean Robinson, and Robert Marshall Wells at Laser, Loot Air Student Radio.
Special thanks to A. Martin Wainwright, the author of Virtual History, How Video Games Portray the Past, and Gamer Nation, Video Games and American Culture by John Wills.
Access to the Martin J. Neeb Center was coordinated through the School of Arts and Communications at PLU. Thanks to Dean Cameron Bennett, Office Assistant Helen Hickman, and former Senior Administrative Assistant Beth Miller. We'll miss you, Beth.
Thanks also to Dale and Jolita Benson, founders and sustainers of the Benson Family Foundation.